Chapter 14. The Lies of Politicians. The atmosphere in Berlin on the morning of August 1, 1914, was one of deep gloom. Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg paced the carpeted floors of his office in long strides, scarcely comprehending what was going on, looking at the future with deep foreboding. According to Malcolm Thompson, as the evening wore on, gloom deepened in the Foreign Office in Berlin. When Theodor Wolff of the Berliner Tageblatt looked in, he found a silence like the grave in the midst of which diplomats brooded in the old-fashioned armchairs. The old Hungarian nobleman Szojany, who was the Austrian ambassador, looked like one from whom despair had drained the last drop of blood. Jago, the German foreign minister, padded in and out with a fixed, ambiguous smile. In Vienna, Chancellor Berchtold was scarcely in a better state. Impeccable as ever in his detachable collar and cravat fixed with a pearl stickpin, he was stuffing himself with sleeping pills. He had failed to detect the Russian hand behind the Serbian conspiracy, rendering his bluster at the Belgrade government less than useless. The German Kaiser found his imprudence unpardonable. Would that he had watered his fine Tokay wine a bit during that fateful July. It would have been much better to be clear-headed. Now it was too late. The Russian army would soon be crossing the borders of Austria-Hungary. In St. Petersburg, the leaders of the war faction were assailed by a last flurry of panic. The Great War was really on. Sukhomlinov, the Minister of War, was quaking in his boots. He had set up a number of icons and votive candles on his desk, and crossed himself frequently. Perhaps alone in a calm state, Wilhelm II refused to order the German army to mobilize, despite von Moltke's anguished pleas. Although, as the Franco-German Commission on the Origins of the War was to recognize in 1935, the Russian general mobilization created a new fait accompli that urgently called for a German decision, it was not until 7 o'clock on the evening of July 31 that the Kaiser went so far as to decree a state of Kriegsgefahrzustand, status of war alert, which was still only a preliminary measure to mobilization. Kriegsgefahrzustand, a rumbling, ominous teutonism, which propagandists in France immediately seized on to conjure up images of Hunnish hordes set to swarm across the border. Their leader, Tardieu, who was fluent in German, mendaciously assured the populace that the word meant that the Germans had just declared a state of war, unleashing nationwide hysteria. How could France hesitate to fly to arms, if Germany was already on the march? Alone of the French leaders, Abel Ferry, Undersecretary of State, an honest patriot who would die in battle, had recognized his superiors' maneuvering for what it was. In his notebook he wrote, "The web was spun and Germany entered it like a great buzzing fly." Kaiser Wilhelm was thinking along similar lines. On the same day, he reflected, "The net has fallen on our heads." Germany had blundered into the trap. Fabre Luce would later write, "This whole history unfortunately leaves no room for any doubt. France didn't enter into war following an obligation of honor, as our rulers have often pretended, but, on the contrary, in violation of the Treaty of Defensive Alliance which she had concluded with Russia, and of the Republican Constitution of 1875. On August 1, at 6 o'clock, the German ambassador, Portales, called on Foreign Minister Sazonov to gain an answer to Germany's plea that Russia halt its mobilization. Sazonov replied, "Our mobilization must be continued. That understood, we are prepared to continue negotiations." Negotiating now, while continuing to mobilize, was only a Russian means of playing for time. Portales pressed the point, "I repeat, Excellency, will you stop your mobilization?" Sazonov remained immobile, his eyes intent. Portales repeated his question, once, twice. Sazonov answered, "I have no other reply to give you." Portales offered a sheet of paper in a trembling hand, then began to sob. Germany had declared war on Russia. In spite of everything, the German ambassador in Paris, Baron von Schoen, made a last offer on July 31 to avert war between France and Germany. As everyone recognized, Russia unaided would be no match for Germany and Austria-Hungary. The Baron brought his government's final proposal to Viviani: if France remained neutral, Germany would also remain neutral. It would afterwards be claimed that the German government had demanded at this time that the great French fortresses of Toul and Verdun be turned over to Germany as a guarantee of French neutrality, since the French were later to decipher a telegram to Schön to that effect, but in fact the ambassador made no mention of such a demand and the French were unaware of it at the time. Viviani's answer to the German ambassador had nothing to do with the right and high principles with which French spokesmen were wont to couch their official rhetoric. It came in seven cold words: France will be guided by her interests. In this case, of course, France's interest meant cutting her powerful German rival down to size and seizing Alsace and Lorraine once more. Poincaré's public declaration was more in keeping with the flowery hypocrisies of the Third Republic. At this hour there are no longer any parties, there is only France, peace-loving and resolute, there is only France eternal, there is only the fatherland of right and justice. Right had a broad back, and Poincaré would ride it for several years. The day before, Austria-Hungary had attempted a last appeal to the French government, presented by emissaries from neutral Romania and Switzerland. Romania's Lahovary and Switzerland's Lardy brought the proposal to the Quai d'Orsay, where Secretary-General Berthelot coldly rejected it. "It is too late," he said. "It is no longer possible to set matters straight." Later it would emerge that Berthelot had not even bothered to transmit the Austrian proposal to his chief, Viviani. Meanwhile, the French generals, no less than their counterparts in Russia, were pressing for a swift mobilization. General Joffre reported that every 24 hours delay in mobilizing would mean a pullback of 15 to 20 kilometers, which would have left the French army at the foot of the Eiffel Tower in a month's time. The generals shortly had their wish. At 3:45 p.m. on August 1, Messemy, the Minister of War, transmitted the order for general mobilization to the Deputy Chief of the General Staff, General Labine. Posters bloomed colorfully throughout the cities, towns, and villages of France, as if an electoral campaign were underway. It would be a landslide for death. Once again, the Poincaré government would manufacture a face-saving lie. Like their allies in Russia, who claimed to have begun mobilizing only after Austria had begun, the Poincaré government claimed that it was Germany which had forced their hand by mobilizing first. The fact of the matter is that the German order to mobilize came at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 15 minutes after the French order. Berlin and Paris are in different time zones. These lies would be told and retold over the years, sturdy bricks in the edifice of German war guilt. Although Poincaré would be forced to admit in 1923 that indeed the Russians had mobilized before the Austrians, he would claim that he had been honestly mistaken. Even so, standard works in France, such as Bonifacio's Manual of History, the mainstay of French students, continued to date Russia's mobilization from July 31, 1914, 40 years after the war. So it is with the lies of politicians, especially victorious politicians. Their lying declarations command widespread belief at the time, when, much later, rectification is made, most people are no longer interested, especially when the truth appears only in the thick and recondite works of historical specialists. In fact, so nervous was Poincaré about the prospect of Germany not mobilizing at an opportune time for French propaganda that he proposed to his ministers that France contrive an incident on the German border. Although the council rejected it as too provocative and dangerous, Malvy revealed Poincaré's proposal after the war. As Fabre Lust summed up, at the beginning of August 1914, Wilhelm II, by hesitating to attack France for the moment, was jeopardizing the script. Hence the notion put forward by Poincaré to the Council of Ministers to create a border incident, so that he would not have the Parliament discussing his interpretation of the Franco-Russian Treaty of Alliance.